those were the chants ringing through the Iowa Capitol building during a hearing on House File 2082, which would have stripped trans Iowans of civil rights protections. This bill proposal comes as many in Iowa grow concerned with increasingly authoritarian policies. Lawyer and Iowa City City Council member Laura Burgess co-authored a piece in Little Village magazine about this rising authoritarianism. In this interview, she talks about anti-protest laws, why the government is targeting trans Iowans, and how those in government look to consolidate power. You wrote about authoritarianism in Iowa for the Little Village magazine, and kind of at the center of like this discussion too is there were 7 trans protesters arrested at the Chloe Cole speech. What's your interpretation of like that arrest process?
Well, I don't really know much about the arrest process itself. In this case, and what I, you know, tried to portray in the op-ed is that there's a point at which the facts matter less, and that's kind of where I think these cases land, because the context of the law, the context of what was happening that day, I think is what's most important in shining a light on the fact that whether it was the officers exercising their discretion to bring charges or the county attorney exercising their discretion to prosecute, I believe those actions were done with good intent. But the law itself coming through our legislature in the way at the time and with the legislative intent that it did should weigh into the consideration of what is just in this case. And in my opinion, it's not just.
So you see the main issue as these Back to Blue laws that were passed?
Correct, and specifically in this case, the anti-protest elements of that.
How do these Back to Blue laws work, and what's their initial purpose?
I believe, based on where they've been enacted elsewhere in the country and models that we've seen in other countries, that the intent is to increase the power of the government in limiting power of the people to dissent. And so the idea is you take several different elements. Here we have a common protest activity of blocking the street, which, by the way, there are several other existing offenses prior to this Back the Blue law that could be used to prosecute for blocking a roadway. But the enhanced penalty relating to that when it is done at the same time as limiting the liability for a motorist who might injure a protester who's blocking the street, and increasing immunity for law enforcement who are interacting, in this case, you know, specifically with protesters, although the law isn't specific in that way. It's part of a overall scheme to chill and minimize people's safety and ability to voice their dissent against the government.
On Tuesday of this week, there was the Capitol hearing for House Study Bill 649, and there the security at the Capitol told protesters that they had to be silent or else they would be arrested. What do you take from these threats?
Again, I don't know the specifics of that case. I think it's, I've certainly been at the Capitol in the rotunda, participated in protests there, where regardless of what, you know, quote unquote side of an issue people were on, definitely not silent. I also have been inside hearing rooms where I understand how disruptive it is to have people outside shouting, and there are reasonable limitations that the First Amendment provides as far as the government's ability to limit the time, place, and manner of how people express themselves. I think where we need to pay closer attention is when it's something like a couple days earlier, protesters were allowed to act a certain way on a similar topic, and then a few days later, enhanced security, required silence, and just thinking about what that means for those individuals' ability to influence the public servants who work for them, who are making decisions in those hearing rooms.
It's like kind of a difference in how they act upon it from day one to day two, or just not congruent with how they would be acting before, right?
I think a cynical take that I don't know if that's correct in this circumstance or not, but a cynical take would be the legislators and Capitol Security maybe didn't anticipate the level of dissent that was there the day of the hearing relating to removing gender identity as a protected class from the Iowa Civil Rights Act, and then responded to that by clamping down on people's ability to influence, seek to influence the legislators at the Tuesday hearing a few days later.
In your view, it was definitely an attempt to like silence protesters and the government using the power, their power to do that.
When you have Capitol security literally telling people to be silent, I don't think there's any other way to interpret it.
So the Iowa City Human Rights Commission came to the conclusion that the arrests were a violation of their civil rights. Do you know how they came to that conclusion?
I don't. I think what I do know just from some conversations I had with a couple of the commissioners is that there were individuals on the commission who had had conversations with county attorney, I should say communications. I don't know if they were face-to-face or on the telephone or an email, but communications with county attorney's office as well as UI Police Department. And UIPD were the ones who made these arrests, brought the charges, I should say, against these seven protesters who are with the pending charges now. So I think they probably took information that they received from UIPD, from the county attorney's office, as well as from their understanding as commissioners whose job it is to see and seek to address human rights violations, that type of action by a government, I think they have a good lens through which to evaluate that. So I don't know exactly what their decision-making process was, but I do know it was a unanimous vote by all the commissioners who were there.
What kind of oversight does the Iowa City government have over the University of Iowa campus police?
Really none. I would say we have good working relationships. So I know that the Iowa City Police Department has a good working relationship with UIPD and vice versa. And so I think there's certainly the ability to influence through those professional relationships, but there is not oversight. Certainly UIPD has authority to enforce the law beyond just university property, just as Iowa City Police could enforce law on university property.
To what extent is the University of Iowa Police controlled by the state government itself?
I mean, I think completely insofar as the University of Iowa is a state entity, I do not know the chain of command from UIPD to the Board of Regents. I don't know what what the steps are in between, but yeah, I think it's fair to consider them, law enforcement of the state. I would imagine that there are laws and rules that I'm just not aware of that would give that a lot more detail and nuance.
Could the University of Iowa Police be acting on like the demands of the state government or the Governor Reynolds herself?
I think that's theoretically possible. In this case, I don't think that happened. And I say that because I know that V. Fixmer Rives, who's a Johns County supervisor who co-authored that editorial with me, I know that they spoke with a UIPD representative and was convinced that that was not the case of what was going on. And I know they have a good working relationship as well. So, and I think that was one of my points, is just really like the intent can be good. Mm-hmm. The intent can be good, but you have all of these steps where the system works to protect people if the laws are just. Right? And if they're not, and the system works to enforce those laws, every step along the way can cause harm, even worse than, laws that are made with good intent. So I think in this particular case, I don't believe that there was some, direction or order from somewhere in Des Moines, but anything's possible.
Over the past year, the Iowa government has banned gender-affirming care for trans youth and disallowed schools from just teaching about queer people in general.
Yeah.
Why do you think the Iowa government is targeting trans people?
I think there are a handful of extremists in the state government who have control of both the state house, the state senate, and the governor's office who are targeting trans people. I think it is based in hate and fear and misguided Christian white nationalism.
How do you believe like the targeting of trans people plays into this whole general authoritarianism slant that the Iowa government has been imposing on its citizens?
What we have seen throughout history and throughout the world is that when a government seeks to exert more and more and more control over its people, it starts with those who are most vulnerable, with those who are least able to push back effectively. And I think that's what you're seeing here, right? Trans people have been on the margins forever. And I think this is an obvious illustration of how that can work. And certainly there have been many good analogies or ways in which people can look back to the Holocaust and say who was targeted first and how did that expand over time until you had, you know, widespread genocide. And I think it's just important to remember that every person's freedom and liberation is tied to every other person's freedom and liberation. And so, you know, while a certain individual might not feel directly impacted by what's happening, we have to push back now and we have to pay attention and call it what it is, because it will only expand.
What do you think the government's intentions are with imposing these authoritarian policies and actions?
Control. It's the same reason that public education is being eroded. It's the same reason that the administrative part of the government is being gutted. The reorganization of state government that occurred through legislation beginning last year is really, I don't know how else to say it, it's just a hollowing out of the government for the purpose of making it ineffective, so that, you know, those few people who have can hoard the power that they have, can retain the power that they have, and can exert control in whatever way that they see fit. It's eliminating checks and balances, whether those are internal, you know, through career people in the executive who are really working for the public, you know, regardless of the administration they're working for, destroying those parts of the institution. Certainly, you know, minimizing people's power in the streets and at the local level to speak their dissent to the government is a big part of reducing checks and balances. In my professional life, I'm an attorney, and so I see the ways in which our court system is being strained and in different places collapsing, and certainly at the national level, I think the Supreme Court lacks integrity. And so I think it's all part of not necessarily a like giant conspiracy where it's really only three people, but I think it's just the momentum of that kind of consolidation of power that I'm sure relates to consolidation of wealth. And I don't personally know what all of those ties are, but I think even the last few years with the government in the state of Iowa, for example, during the pandemic, the fact that there was, you know, a particular vendor that got a $26 million contract for some, you know, software package without any kind of public bidding or, you know, request for proposals or that kind of thing. So it's the removing of the regulatory state, which allows for more corruption and more, consolidation of wealth and power.
Do you think this drive for power is centered on having legislators increase their own personal wealth, or could there be other reasons behind it?
I would imagine it's a multitude of reasons. I think that is one driver. As a politician, I can say that I see and understand better than I was before I was an elected official. I can see and understand the temptation of power and of retaining that. And I think what we're seeing in the U.S. currently is that the present civil rights movement and the push for truly addressing hundreds of years of oppression of certain populations and addressing the harms of capitalism and addressing the inequities of wealth and power, like, people want to rise up. And I think what we're seeing is the clamping down to try to ensure that that can't happen. But if you look at like what's happened in organized labor over the last few years, like, people are saying we do not want the current system. And so I think this is those who have the power now are doing everything they can to retain it.
For those who are fighting back against the current system that's trying to shut them down, what do you think the best strategies are? What can they do to fight back against authoritarianism in Iowa?
Yeah, talk about it first. Talk about it. Keep talking about it. I have had so many conversations with folks who believe that my position and the things that I'm saying out loud to you here are an overreaction or it can't really be that way. And that's why I try to be intentional in saying I don't think it's some conspiracy. You know, I don't think our county attorney ever talked to the governor or anything like that. But we have seen this play out in other places and over time. And there is a playbook, and the playbook is being followed here. And so for us to put on blinders and imagine that we'll have some positive social change to get Iowa back to a place where we value everyone and we value education and we value freedom, it won't happen if we don't try to stop what's going on right now. And so I think to try to directly answer your question, in addition to talking about it and calling it what it is, holding leaders accountable, you know, trying to speak to them in the ways that we are accessible to say, you know, I see this and I don't know, that doesn't seem right, that doesn't feel right, or I've been harmed, or my, you know, people close to me, people I care about have been harmed. This is what my community is feeling and seeing. I'm close with a number of trans people, and I think that may be one reason why I feel very, very passionately about this right now. And I think I can see that difference in some people who I've spoken with, that maybe they don't see it as urgent based on who are the people that they love the most. But it takes all of us. It takes people who are working in the systems to stand up and say, the parts of the system that should protect us are failing. What can we do? It takes people working alongside the system. So, you know, building positive relationships with people who do have power, who we don't think are abusing that power, and encouraging them to wield their power in ways that are protective and helpful. And it takes people working against the system. And that's the protest part, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you have to have all three. You have to be inside, alongside, and against in order to obtain any kind of real change.
Those are all the questions I have. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I don't know. I think a thing that I say often, even before we were in this more acute moment of horror that we're in the legislative session, I often say two things. We are all we have, and we are powerful. Right? That's one. That's one thing. We are all we have, and we are powerful, because we forget how much power each of us can wield. And I sat through part of the closing arguments of the trial of two defendants who had dumped marbles at the IMU when Matt Walsh was here. I sat through part of the closing arguments of that trial yesterday, and it was just so striking to me that these two individuals pushing their case to trial rather than pleading out was, or just pleading, you know, guilty even as charged, was so powerful. The way that it forced a shining of the light on what exactly was happening here in the local government, and, you know, what this law was, what the actions were, what the protest was about, is just so powerful. And that's a particularly courageous stance for those folks to take. But I just think sometimes we don't know. Like when V and I wrote that editorial, it has been cited back to us so many times. And we had no idea. We just felt like this was a thing that needed to be said, and gosh, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are talking about it, so let's go ahead and talk about it. And it has had a lot of ripple effects that I didn't anticipate. So, you know, we have to count on each other, we have to count on ourselves, and we have to know that we hold that power. And then the other thing that I say a lot is, nobody knows how this works. I think one of the lies of modern capitalism and power dynamics is that we are indoctrinated to believe that there are people who are like better than us that are running things, right? We're made to believe that someone is in charge somewhere, and surely they know what's going on. Surely they are smart and well organized and well resourced. And as in my personal experience, as I've been exposed to and then held more positions of power, both as an attorney, officer of the court, and then as an elected official, that is not true. We are it. And so people who say that there's a way that things work, or that the system wants this, or they want something to happen, that's not how it is. It's just people making decisions just like you and I do for the exact same human reasons. And most of those are driven by personal relationships. Most of those are based on, you know, how our brains evolved. it's not that complicated, but we have to own the fact that there aren't people who are going to make change without us participating in the change. So nobody knows how it works. And if somebody tells you that they do and that you're doing it wrong, it may be because they feel threatened. It may be because they're trying to get you to sit down and be quiet, mm-hmm. and just to be aware of that so that you can make choices on how you might want to resist.